Hello, I'm Michael Bott.
And I'm Rupert Soskin. Welcome to another Prehistory Guys interview, introducing you to archaeologists and historians all too often hidden behind the scenes and finding out what they're up to while the world isn't watching.
Today we're talking with archaeologist Sue Greeney, senior properties historian with English Heritage, editor of Past, the newsletter of the Prehistoric Society, and the main reason we wanted to get her on, Sue is the author of a fantastic piece of research on the Megahenge complex of Mount Pleasant in Dorset.
It's always fascinating to hear Sue talk about her work. Hope you enjoy it. Sue, hi. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing? And where are you? Don't even know where you are at the moment.
Yes. True.
Good afternoon. I'm in my house in Bristol, where it is a particularly hot and sunny day, but nicely indoors in the shade.
As long as you're in the shade. That's good. That's good. Yeah. Well, do you know what? Our interviews always start off with the same question, because everybody wants to know, what is it that actually started you off? What started your passion for archaeology in the first place?
I think it was at primary school. I remember being about 7 years old and saying to my mum one day, I want to be an archaeologist. And at the time, I'm not sure she... I think she knew what that was, but I think a lot of my schoolmates didn't. I was very lucky. I had a primary school teacher who taught us by theme. So we did the Vikings and we did the Normans and we did the ancient Egyptians. I remember being fascinated by all of these particular, you know, historical periods. But then one day I remember seeing a picture of somebody in a trench, and it must have been in some textbook or kids' book or something. Picture of somebody in a trench with a brief description of what an archaeologist did. And I thought, that's it. That's what I want to do. And I've never changed my mind since. So,
Age seven, that's amazing.
Age seven, yeah.
What was the journey from that? I mean, how did you acquire your first skills? Where was the first dig? How did you get to university?
What was the path through to?
Yeah.
My parents were very encouraging, and I enrolled in my local YAC, my young archaeology club. I was a YAC member in my kind of early teenage years. And when I got to about 14, I did work experience, where you go off for a couple of weeks from school and spend time in the real world. And I went and did work experience with Northamptonshire Archaeology, who were the county unit at the time. I did 2 weeks with them, working on a deserted medieval village site up near Rugby. Absolutely loved it. Thought the people were brilliant. Just loved the work. I was only 14, but in those days you could go and work on a commercial site for a couple of weeks. I went back for a couple of weeks in my summer as a volunteer. And from there on, I just was hooked, really, on the fieldwork side of it. So each summer, I went and did various different kind of student and volunteer digs. I worked, my local site was Piddington Roman Villa, which is a community excavation in Northamptonshire, which is where I grew up. Lovely Roman villa. I remember discovering a beautiful little copper, I think it was copper alloy ear scoop from the bathhouse there. And it was just one of those objects that kind of pinged out the ground as you were traveling along. So really lovely discovery. And not even knowing, I thought it was a tent peg at first, you know, it looked so modern and so clean. I was like, what is this? So I took it and they say, oh, this is very exciting. You found this, you know, piece of Roman toiletry tool. So and then I signed up to go to Sedgford, which is the Sharp Dig, Sedgford Historical and Archaeological Research Project in North Norfolk, not far from Hunstanton, which again was a kind of community-led training dig. And I went there. I signed up for 2 weeks when I was about, I think I must have been about 16 or so. I went off on my own, 2 weeks camping. And I remember ringing my mum and dad from the payphone in the pub and saying, can I stay longer? Can I use some of my savings from my paper round to stay longer for another week? Yeah. So again, that site was a big part of my life for 2 or 3 years, going and excavating in the summers. And in between my first and second year of university, they asked me back to be a supervisor there for the full season. So that was eight weeks living in the field, digging the field, training others, kind of, you know, living and breathing archaeology the whole summer. So that was a really good experience in getting me kind of a good excavator, you know, trained, working alongside people who'd been trained at a variety of other universities and had great skills. So so by the time I got to university, I went to Sheffield.
Yep.
Sadly, just announced they're going to close the department there.
I know, shocking. Yeah.
But yeah, so I went to Sheffield in 2001 and did an archaeology and prehistory degree. I particularly chose Sheffield because it had a picture of South Uist of Nailed Hebrides on the front cover of their prospectus. And it made me think, oh, imagine going out to dig on the Nailed Hebrides. Yes, please. Yeah. So that, and the fact that I just loved Sheffield. It seemed such a friendly city. It was in the north. It was cheap. It felt right. It felt very friendly going there. So yeah, I had a very happy 3 years at Sheffield University, learning all the theory, learning all the prehistory, you know, being taught by some really inspiring people, including Mike Parker Pearson, John Barrett, Marek Zwelibel, Robin Dannell, Maureen Carroll, just some people who were just really inspiring, enthusiastic, and leading their own really exciting research projects. It was a good time to be at Sheffield, I think.
Yeah. You later went on to Oxford.
That's right.
Yeah. But going back, though, I'm talking about your mentors. Have they... you know, their disciplines, their particular interests, you know, really influenced the directions that you went in. So,
to a certain extent, yes. So Mike Parker Pearson was my personal tutor at Sheffield.
Oh, right.
And he was very inspiring, you can't help but be engaged in archaeology if you're being taught by somebody like Mike. Mm. And I remember him setting us an essay question on the Amesbury Archer, which had only recently been discovered at that point. And what he was trying to get out of the students was his idea for the Beaker People Project, which was this project to look at the isotopes of Beaker burials from across Britain and Ireland to see whether any of them were immigrants from the continent. And I remember doing this essay and thinking, what is he trying to get at here? I know he's trying to get at something beyond where I could get to as a student. So I remember him setting that, and it was a bit of a challenge to see if we could come up with the same project that he'd come up with, which is a bit of a hard task for an undergraduate student. But Beaker burials, the Neolithic monuments. I mean, we went on annual trips to Stonehenge and Avebury with Mike Parker Pearson or John Barrett. So got two sides of a kind of interesting story there. But also in my later years at Sheffield, I was taught a lot by Mark Edmonds, who... was obviously a very strong landscape archaeologist and taught us a huge amount about kind of looking at landscapes, investigating landscapes. And at the time, my boyfriend, who is now my husband, was doing the MA in landscape archaeology with Mark Edmonds. He was in the year above me. And I used to try and get in on their weekend field trip. So every week they went on a field trip out to the Peak District usually, or further afield. Yeah. And in the pub on the Friday night, I used to say, can I come along tomorrow? And he'd be like, oh yeah, if you turn up at the minibus, you can come. So trips out to kind of Flag Fen and various sites in the Peak District, Chatsworth and all the prehistoric sites. You know, that was really amazing opportunity as well. So yeah, learnt a lot from Mark and his way of approaching archaeology.
Living the dream, Sue. Living the dream.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, you've worked with English Heritage for a long time now, haven't you? So, number one, what does it mean to you to have Stonehenge as a kind of constant place of work? Are you still enthralled by it, or has it kind of become normal?
It still enthralls me. I've been with English Heritage for 16 years, but I haven't worked directly with Stonehenge for all of that time. It was only from about 2009 onwards, so for about 10, 11 years now, that I've been really focused on Stonehenge. Before that, I was working on properties that we look after all across the country. I was working specifically on our free and unstaffed sites. So all those small little gems that everyone forgets about, all those long barrows and dolmens, all those stone circles, and also medieval monasteries, medieval castles. So I learnt in my first few years at English Heritage a huge amount about things I didn't know. So medieval stuff, you know, churches, how churches are laid out, how monasteries are laid out, what to look for at particular castle sites, how to interpret them and do reconstructions, how to write interpretive text, you know, how to write exhibition type text, and how to research, you know, these state guardianship monuments using all the kind of tools available to us. So that was a really good grounding. And I stepped away from prehistory, which was really my specialism at university and is again now. But then in 2009, the Stonehenge Visitor Centre project came back on board and they were looking for somebody to join the team to really be the archaeologist and expert on developing all of the content for the new exhibition, the new guidebook, landscape interpretation, et cetera, et cetera. So I joined the team at that point. And I remember thinking, oh yes, I'm back with prehistory. This is the stuff cool. I really enjoy getting my teeth into. You know, nice to go and visit a medieval castle and lovely to think about a monastery, but really prehistory is the kind of exciting stuff, isn't it? So immersed myself in Stonehenge really for a very intense series of years in the lead up to the opening of the visitor centre in 2013. So about 4 years spent putting the huge Heritage Lottery Fund bid in, developing all of the content, working with all of the creative, brilliant people who were making our films and our models, doing the Neolithic Houses project at Stonehenge, so sort of overseeing the replica houses that we built there. Really intense, really good, really great experience, but I kind of went from very small free sites where there might be one panel to, you know, the opposite, Stonehenge, you know, international World Heritage Site. So that was a fairly steep learning curve, really.
Yeah. Do you know what? It's an interest to us, you know, that thing between sites that are not looked after or not paid for, you know, and places that do have a visitor centre. And there's a cusp between the two. It's a very strange area where people have access, but they're not managed. And at what point a monument becomes in need of help in order to prevent it from, you know, going under from the weight of that. But I don't suppose that's anything that you're concerned with anymore in your present role.
Yeah, though, no, I still do write interpretation for our free sites. I spent a couple of weeks ago, went up to Nine Ladies Stone Circle and Arbelow in the Peak District to have a look with a colleague at what we can do to improve the interpretation there. So I still do pick up free sites. And actually, they're the best ones, really. They're lovely. And they're in beautiful out-of-the-way places. And they, you know, people love them for what they are. They're not places where you have to buy a ticket and go through the gift shop or anything like that. They are just what they are. So in some ways, they're my favourite sites to deal with. They're just small and self-contained. It's a funny quirk of history how English heritage have come by its state monuments. It's a very strange, eclectic mix of things that went on the 1882 schedule, in the very first schedule of ancient monuments.
Nine Ladies was one of the first.
Yes, exactly. So, and a lot of those were prehistoric in that first tranche. And then ones that have been kind of acquired or donated, or it's a very slightly strange ragtag of bag of sites we've got. So by far not always the most important or the most significant, but ones that were they could persuade the owners to put into state guardianship a lot of the time. But obviously there are some jewels in that crown, and Stonehenge is one of those, although we have some pretty impressive other prehistoric sites too, Maiden Castle and Castlerigg, and you know, all these amazing sites. So
we'd all like a clearer view of Mount Pleasant and your doctorate research there. I suppose one thing, I mean, working at Mount Pleasant, and we should explain, Mount Pleasant is a mega henge complex very near Dorchester. So your work there, how did you get to be working at Mount Pleasant? You know, was it something that you drove towards and saw an opening and so I'm going to do that? And, you know, what fascinated you in the first place to take you there?
Well, the work at Mount Pleasant is all part of my PhD. So my PhD research I am undertaking part-time at Cardiff University alongside my job at English Heritage. And I was looking at monument complexes. So these are clusters or groups of monuments that seem to kind of emerge in particular places. And the area around Stonehenge is one of those, where you have not just Stonehenge, but lots of other important monuments, some of which are still visible today, some of which are now lost. And what I wanted to do is try and contribute to this kind of story of complexes. And looking around, there was one particular complex that had been really well investigated in the 1960s and 1970s, but really no one had gone back since. And it was a sort of untapped archive, really. So I decided that it would be a great idea as part of my PhD research to get together a new and accurate chronology for the Dorchester complex, which includes the Mount Pleasant Henge. So that was the sort of starting point, was kind of trying to fill a gap really in our knowledge and trying to produce another example of a monument complex where we've got really good evidence for the chronology about how that complex develops and emerges and changes over time, and mapping that. So my, part of my PhD is sort of mapping in detail, both chronologically and geographically, how these complexes develop and emerge and change over time. And Mount Pleasant had been excavated in 1970 by Geoffrey Wainwright, and he had published a beautiful monograph at the same time he was excavating other mega henges at Marden and at Durrington Walls to the north near Stonehenge. But no one had gone back since. The site had not been excavated since. It was, it was, and it's still sadly under the plough. It's a fairly neglected and forgotten example of one of these mega henges because the earthworks have completely disappeared. They've been ploughed out. You can really only identify the monument from aerial photographs and geophysical survey. And so I thought, well, this is a great example of one. No one's working on this. No one's doing any research on this. Let's see if we can go back to the archive and see what we can date, basically. So the idea was to try and produce some more accurate dating. And Mount Pleasant is a really interesting monument because it's got a number of different components. There's the henge itself, the bank and the ditch, which surround this sort of hilltop, enormous site, huge banks and ditches. But then it also has a concentric timber monument in the middle, which is originally named as Site 4. It's a very romantic name, but that's what we still call it, Site 4. And also a timber palisade, a sort of fence line of large posts that ran around the inside of the henge bank. And also a barrow called the Conquer Barrow, which sits just at the side on top of, it seems, the henge bank. So all these different components might be the same dates, might be vastly different dates. And the kind of accepted chronology was really based on what Geoff had done in 1970. And although radiocarbon dates were used at the time, they had huge error ranges and they weren't necessarily the samples that we would select today to get the best idea of when these different events had occurred. So I went to the archive, which is kept by Dorset County Museum in Dorchester, and just had a look to see what there was, see if it had been good records, see if there were labels on all of the finds still. And actually the first thing I looked at was animal bones, because one of the things you would ideally want to date would be some nice articulated animal bones from the very bottom of a ditch, for example. And I was really disappointed because I opened up the boxes and they were just a jumble. There were all the bones had been accumulated into just periods. So there was a Neolithic box and there was a Bronze Age box and there were lots of Iron Age boxes. And all of the contexts were lost. All the bags were there with their numbers on, but they'd been emptied. So there's no way you can reunite the bones with the bags that they came from, even though they've kept the bags. At some point between now and 1970, someone had gone through and... So they were completely unsuitable for dating. It, much as I tried, I could not match up any of the records and publications with what there was. But there were very good antler picks, and those were all individually labelled and marked and had very good evidence for where they'd come from. And there was masses and masses of charcoal. So charcoal from the posts, for example, of this palisade, charcoal from underneath the henge bank, lots of really good samples. So and also some what turned out to be much later Iron Age burials that came from the ditch, which we dated as well. So we were able to get a really good selection of samples. And I have to say, the we in this is myself and Peter Marshall, who is the Historic England scientific dating expert. And I was able to have his help because my PhD is funded through something called doctoral training partnerships, which are done in association with non-university bodies. And English Heritage / Historic England, which was also the organisation I was working for, basically said they would help me a bit with training and with some funding for the dates in order to kind of train me up and be able to do this radiocarbon dating type project. So yeah, so Mount Pleasant was the first monument that we tackled as part of that Dorchester complex. And we've now published the paper last year on the results from that. But there's more in the pipeline. So we have actually dated samples from all of the major monuments in the Dorchester complex. So that includes a sort of early henge or proto-henge called Flagstones, another huge timber enclosure known as Greyhound Yard after the site where it was first identified under the town of Dorchester, and the really unusual henge monument of Mombry Rings, which is a very strange monument, which is still standing today, and you can go and visit the earthworks. But the ditch of which had these enormously deep shafts, about 45 of them, dug down metres and metres and metres into the chalk with all kinds of things stuffed into them. So we've been able to date all of those major monuments and build up a really detailed chronology for that complex as a whole.
Yeah. Well, really I don't think there's time to sort of describe that all here. So am I getting this right? There's majorly an archival research project. You weren't able to go out and get your hands dirty and get the trowel out.
There was no need. There was no need. I mean, all of these sites were beautifully excavated. Some of the 1970s and 80s work is absolutely stunning. You know, all the photographic records are there, all the context sheets are there. Going through the archive is a pleasure, and all of the finds are there. So, you know, there's no need to go and, in effect, damage more of the site or do an expensive excavation when there's this sort of material sitting in the archive. And Dorset County Museum were very kind. You know, they gave us permission to sample pretty much as we wanted, really. So they were very happy to let us do that and kind of be able to tell more stories from their own archive.
Whilst being hugely frustrating at the same time. Do you want to get out with your trowel?
I do a bit. But actually, I kind of find it fascinating that you can ask such big, major questions and just use the archive to get there. I mean, yes, getting a trowel out would be exciting, but at Mount Pleasant, you need a big JCB as well. It would be a major, major project to excavate, for example, a portion of that henge ditch. And that's a huge operation. As a PhD student, you do not have the funds or the time or the ability to kind of do that kind of level of thing. So actually going back to the archive, choosing things for radiocarbon dating or, you know, other scientific analysis, whether that be looking at pottery residues or looking at ancient DNA, they're perfect subjects for a PhD level student to get their hands on because they, you know, they're bounded and small. So
long story short, though, I mean, what's the emerging picture for you from Mount Pleasant, from the chronology and the whole complex, you know?
At Mount Pleasant,
Mount Pleasant itself,
At Mount Pleasant, it was originally thought that the monument was built over a very long time period, so that the henge was built sometime in the late Neolithic, and then the palisade, this wooden timber palisade, was added much later in the early Bronze Age. But what the dating that we've done has shown is that they're pretty much all the same date. So they all come out, each component of the monument was built quite quickly in succession, and they're all roughly 2500 BC. So there's a big frenzy of building at that point. The ditch around site 4, it has a little circular ditch, was a little bit later, but that's quite normal to find a kind of added ditch to some of these kind of earlier timber or stone monuments. And the palisade was also very slightly later than the big henge ditch and bank itself, but all within a space of about 125 years for every single component to be built. So this was a monument that was built, very enormous monument, but then very rapidly, you know, by the children or the grandchildren of the people who'd built the original monument, they were going back and altering it, changing it, altering the entrances, building palisades, adding bits and pieces to it. So it was a monument that was kind of quite rapidly changing over time.
And the chronology aside, are you any closer to an interpretation that you're comfortable with, particularly, you know, the timber site 4? I'll call it site 4, concentric timber circle,
So site 4 is one of a kind of group of timber, and sometimes they have stone component monuments. Site 4 actually has a little stone cove at the centre of it, as well as it being a timber structure. So it's very similar to places like Woodhenge, to the Southern Circle at Durrington Walls, for example. And it has, what's interesting about Site 4 is it has these four little avenues that lead into it from each of the kind of cardinal directions, in effect, to the centre. And it's one of a number of monuments that appear to be orientated specifically to particular directions. So if you plot all these different timber monuments, they all have sort of not precise alignments like Stonehenge, but they are generally orientated in a particular way. And Site 4 is very similar to that. So it's if I had to tell you what Site 4, it's a timber temple. You know, it's one of those places where people are depositing lots of objects, pottery, animal bones, antler picks, and moving around the monument in particular sort of prescribed routes and depositing objects in particular parts of the monument. So it's a temple of sorts where people are kind of adding offerings. What those timber posts look like, you know, were they decorated? Were they hung with objects? Were they painted? Who knows? But so I mean, Mount Pleasant is in this class of mega henges, which seems to be places where people were gathering in really large numbers and having these enormous feasts. Yeah. So similar to Durrington Walls, where we've also got evidence for midwinter feasting, at Mount Pleasant it's exactly the same. We don't, unfortunately, have the evidence for any houses like we have at Durrington Walls, but I suspect they're there. Okay. I suspect they've either been ploughed or they haven't yet been discovered. So that it's a big settlement and gathering site that's really significant in around 2500 BC.
Yeah. So we tend to regard, I mean, these mega henges, you know, and the complexes around them, we regard them as being hugely important, but so much has been lost between towns and cities that have just carried on developing over the thousands of years. So do you think it's more likely that the country was more uniformly covered by these kind of monuments and settlements, or do you think that they were quite distinct and spread apart?
It's a good question. We've obviously lost a lot. But I would say that at Dorchester, it's a really good example because there was a Roman town built over the top of this Neolithic monument complex. Yeah. And then that Roman town became a medieval town, and then it became the modern city of Dorchester. So it's had a huge amount of building and construction
and
work.
And a Waitrose car park.
And a Waitrose car park, yes. Most exciting red circles of concrete in the Waitrose car park that show you the position of the Greyhound Yard palisaded enclosure, yeah. And those have been found during excavations in the 70s. They were found during, you know, redevelopment for shopping centres and housing and et cetera in the middle. So I have a feeling that if there was a complete monument complex hidden under a city somewhere, we would have found some sign of it. So although we've lost a lot and we may have many new monuments to discover, I do feel that the kind of pattern of complexes that we've got, the major complexes, is pretty correct. Yeah, I'd be happy to be corrected in a few years' time when someone finds something very exciting in a place we've never looked. But I think we're pretty firm on where the major sites are.
Mm. Okay,
because we've been fascinated by the ubiquity of henge-like structures all over the place. You know, it's only recently we started looking at the continent and seeing, oh my goodness, this was a thing. A hengiform, or the earth and the bank and ditch enclosure. Was it serving the same purpose all over the place, or were there different purposes? Because,
Yeah, there's a certain...
Form follows function and all that.
There's a certain fashion, I guess you'd call it, for enclosing places within boundaries of earth and timber. And they are often circular, not always perfectly circular, but this hinging of sites, you've probably heard the term hinging, which is a term you've probably talked
Kenny
about
Brophy.
Before. Yeah, Kenny's idea. Yes. But that's quite nice because at Durrington, for example, we have this henge being built as the kind of final stage of this site. So they're sort of monumentalising and marking out this special place where lots of things have already happened. And I suspect Mount Pleasant may be the same, although we don't have direct evidence for kind of anything before the earth bank and ditch at the moment, so from the current excavations. It's about this kind of keeping in and keeping out, creating boundaries around special places. And whether it's about keeping in and keeping out people, you know, only certain people can go within these spaces, or only certain things can happen inside these bounded spaces, or whether it's about, you know, people have written about whether it's the idea about keeping these powerful places separate from the everyday world, keeping spirits inside, keeping dangerous, you know, activities or beings in this enclosed space. It's different, it's special, it's set aside. That's how we probably ought to think about them, is this demarcating a special place.
Mm-hmm. So any good interpretations of the actual timber structures themselves, these concentric rings of posts? Because there's a lot of contention around those.
Yeah, so originally, perhaps the first one to be excavated was Maud Cunnington's Woodhenge. And she suggested it was a freestanding timber structure. But then later on, Stuart Piggott and many others said, oh, no, of course, it's got to have a roof on top. This is some sort of communal hall or building. I think the consensus has swung back towards Maud's ideas, particularly with Mike Pitts's excavations at the Sanctuary, which is another of these timber monuments near Avebury, where he found that at least one of the timber posts that he excavated had been replaced a number of times in the same place. So you're not going to be replacing individual posts if you've got a roof up there. And it does seem that these are places that people are moving between and around rather than them being a structure or a roofed building as such. They're overly complex, really. You could build a much simpler structure if you wanted to. So they do seem to be freestanding. There are related monuments that we call now square in circle monuments, which are these settings of four socking great posts surrounded by a fence, of which we've got a couple at Durrington. The site four at Mount Pleasant is sort of based on it loosely. There are many others across the whole of Britain and Ireland, but these seem to be a kind of in between a kind of domestic house structure and these really monumental concentric timber structures. They're sort of somewhere in between. So, you know, are those temples or are they actually buildings with four posts going up to the sky out of the roof or something? So there's a continuum, I guess, of architecture from small domestic buildings right the way through to these concentric monuments. But the only thing I would say is that they're temples. They're religious structures, they're ritual structures, they're places where people, I guess, communed with their gods or deities or, you know, whatever their religious beliefs were, which we're very far from ever being able to say for certain. This is where important ritual stuff happens.
I know we've frozen it forever in time in Standing with Stones. We put a roof on it, so we know.
It's possible. I think it's possible.
That was the thinking at the time. That's the trouble, isn't it? Once you put something down, you stick your opinion, you hang your picture on the wall, as it were, and it's there for all time.
We followed the opinions of people who knew more than we did. So
and there's nothing wrong with that. We our reconstructions change and our ideas change all of the time. So we're always kind of learning things. That's a lot of my job is commissioning reconstructions and creating artwork for interpretation exhibitions. And it's always the most challenging thing to do is to say, what do I think?
Isn't it a hard thing? Because it's so hard once you're not setting things in concrete exactly, but the visual interpretation has to be made. Being visual creatures, once we see something a certain way, that tends to get the fixed idea. So I see there's a lot of people sticking roofs on, well, not a lot of people, but people have been sticking roofs on Stonehenge itself.
That does pop up recently. Every now and again. Some classic newspaper articles with, I think it looked like this. Not a huge amount of evidence.
Astonishing the amount of work that put into such things as well, isn't it?
Absolutely.
But I mean, I'd say a roof on Woodhenge is a lot more plausible than a roof on Stonehenge. But if you think that Stonehenge is kind of a stone version of these timber monuments, these timber structures, it's sort of, it's possible they had lintels. It's possibly that they had joints and were worked and shaped in the same way as Stonehenge. Mm. So in some ways that's easier for me to imagine than a roofed structure.
Do you know what? It is on that line, although, you know, I don't favour necessarily the roofed idea. It always seems a bit of overkill, the mortise and tenon in the trilithons. It's a bit overkill unless you expect some kind of lateral force to be applied to the lintels.
The whole monument is completely over-engineered. There's a lot of excess it going into it, deliberately so, probably. You know, those joints are not needed. You could just stick the stones on top of each other if you wanted to. They might not last hundreds and hundreds of years, but if you just want to make a shape, you don't have to create those joints and those slotted together things. And, you know, the fact that the outer circle was completely level, even though the land is not, there is a lot of overthinking and over engineering going into this. Probably
there is a question mark over that for sure. Actually, talking of question marks, if you had the opportunity, Sue, to solve one burning question that you have about the Neolithic or prehistory in general, what's the question and where would you go back to in time to solve it?
I would go back to about 2400 BC, so a bit after these massive monuments are being built. Yeah. Maybe Silbury Hill is still being built. And I'd watch the interaction between new people coming to Britain from the continent with their fancy new beaker pots and their different language and their other religious beliefs, and just see what it was like to see that meeting of people and work out why those people were coming, what the people here thought about them, and how everything changed. Because at that point, everything does change. You know, all the major monument construction comes to a halt. Yeah. You've got people change the way they bury their dead. They change the type of pottery they're using. They've got new metals, copper, gold, later bronze for the first time. And it's a huge sea change. There's some continuity. We know that people with beaker pots are still going back to monuments like Mount Pleasant and sticking their pots in the ground for a little bit of time. But there's really no continuity in terms of kind of, there's no new major monuments constructed. So that bit really interests me, that kind of changeover, that turnover. And there's been some really interesting new work done using ancient DNA to look at this particular question. Yeah. But we've got a big issue with it because we don't know what late Neolithic people were doing with their dead. Yeah. We assume that they're cremating them, and we assume that they're sticking them in the river or the sea, because they're not showing up anywhere archaeologically. We've got a few cremations from Stonehenge itself, but they're a little bit earlier. They're sort of 3000 BC. So what on earth are people doing with their dead that means that they just don't show up? And that means that we haven't got any ancient DNA from that late Neolithic period. But we do see a massive sea change with all of these new people arriving. So what happens there? What's the interaction between? Is it conflict? Is it war? Do they get on? Is it gift exchange? Do they kind of... I imagine it's a bit like... It's not as far, you know, it's 30 miles across the channel, but there is a huge change. So, yeah, I'd just love to be a fly on the wall, see that interaction taking place.
Yes. That is so true, isn't it? When you look at the amount of stuff that was spreading around, whether it's, you know, the recent thing of finding gold in Germany that probably came from Cornwall, that sort of thing, and the recent thing of tin ingots being found in Cyprus and Israel, I think, and Greece, that also, if they didn't come from Cornwall, they came from northern France. It's still this massive interaction between peoples, isn't it? Which
all starts just then, but just before, there's very few clues that show that people are crossing the channel. They probably were, but it just doesn't show up archaeologically. We haven't got, you know, it's not like you find, so the typical pottery of this period is grooveware pottery. We don't have any grooveware pottery from across the channel, yet it's in Ireland and Britain. So that these people are sharing ideas and styles across the Irish Sea, but not across the Channel. And yet, and they're getting metals much earlier in places like northern France and Brittany. There's a delay then before it comes over the Channel. So what is it about that? What's happening there? Yeah. It's kind of intriguing.
It is. So many mysteries. So many mysteries. I'll share your time machine. I wanted to ask you was because we saw that you said you're off on holiday soon. You're going to Arran, aren't you?
Yes.
Has that got anything to do with the LIDAR results of was it 10,000 previously unknown archaeological sites that have thrown up in those scans?
No, it's somewhere I've wanted to go for a long time. There's the amazing Macrimore stone circles there, which I have read about and drawn, but I've never had the chance to visit. There is the new Cursus that they have recently found on Arran, which does intrigue me. I watched a talk by Angela Gannon about that a few months ago at the Neolithic Studies Group conference, but I think it's pretty difficult to find and in an upland area, so I'm not sure I'll be trekking off to find it without some guide. But no, it's also to go to bits of Argyll and up to Kilmartin, because I visited Kilmartin Glen 10 years ago now with a kind of work colleague as a sort of pre-visit when we were developing Stonehenge. But I would absolutely love to go back with proper time to go and see some of the amazing rock art there and see some of the tombs there too. So yeah, there's a few places on my list, although my husband was trained as an archaeologist and worked as an archaeologist for many years, but he will not let me do archaeology every day of the holiday. So there will be some other things mixed in as well.
our paths may cross. We're passing through Kilmartin Glen in September.
Oh,
who knows? I don't know. We'll see.
Yes, we are. Well, Scotland has been a big thing for you. I mean, the Ring of Brodgar?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I have been lucky enough to... Well, I visited Orkney first when I was on just a holiday. Just one of those, you know, got to go and see all these amazing sites. But then I went back. I've been back for two seasons to go and excavate at the Ness of Brodgar, just because, I mean, who wouldn't want to go? I mean, it's such an amazing site to go and have a chance to take part in. And also my PhD was looking at the Stenness Brodgar complex and monument, so I wanted to try and understand a bit more about, you know, how it all fitted together and what the discoveries were there. So yeah, so I've dug a few times, not for a couple of years now sadly, but with the Ness of Brodgar team, which has just been absolutely amazing. And when I was at university, I dug with Mike Parker Pearson at Cladhallan, which is the Bronze Age roundhouses site on South Uist, which again was an extraordinary experience, kind of digging in sand dunes to find Bronze Age structures. Scotland. The islands of Scotland particularly do hold quite a place for me as a kind of, you know, just amazing places to visit, really.
It's true. There is something, we were talking about this recently actually with Alison Sheridan and Lucy at the Callanish Centre, that there is something so profound about some of these extraordinary places that are on tiny islands. You know, it's almost incongruous, really, that these massive and complex structures were just put in these tiny out-of-the-way places.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting, isn't it, to think about why that might be the case. I mean, I think they probably weren't so out of the way at the time. I think they were kind of probably quite nodal in terms of sea routes and, you know, tidal routes and things like that. When I was on Orkney last, I met a couple who had sailed to Orkney from Cardiff in their own boat, and they'd come up the west coast of Scotland and gone through all of the islands and had a fabulous time. And they said it's just very easy because you're always within sight of different harbours and different islands. You can work your way up the west coast right up to Orkney, you know, with not that much skill, really, you know, a bit of skill, but, you know, so for prehistoric people, it would have been the same. They would have been very used to jumping in a boat and crossing over the Irish Sea, I think. Yeah. In some ways, although they're islands, that means they're kind of connected to lots of different places and different people, which means they become these sort of centres.
Oh, glad you said that, because that's a really good perspective to look at things through. Because all when we look at Orkney and think of that horrible stretch between the mainland Scotland and Orkney, and think, how are you going to get across that? It's bad enough on a ferry.
But don't we have this? One of our big weaknesses, I think, is that we still look at the past through our modern eyes. So we look at things, that looks incredibly difficult. Well, probably wasn't. And I wish I could remember who'd written it. I really don't. But I read an article a little while ago of somebody explaining how if you've got a good knowledge of the sea, that to actually go from Scotland right the way down to the south coast would have been an awful lot safer than trying to make the same journey on land, where not only have you got wild animals that you've probably got to be worried about, you've also got random brigands and whoever else might want what you're carrying with you and all of that. So you can see that, yeah, okay, there is a solid reason why people would have been using the water all the time. But nevertheless, when you look at the distances they travelled in what we would regard as pretty primitive boats, it's still an extraordinary feat, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And don't forget that obviously inland, masses of woodland, lots and lots of trees, and presumably, you know, pathways and trackways, but tricky to, you know, navigate and difficult to find your way all the way. I think coastlines would have been a lot easier.
Easier to get lost. No, I come to think of it. Yeah.
My undergraduate dissertation was on rock art in Southwest Ireland, and I called that the paper that came out of that Routeways and Seaways, because so much of the rock art this was on the Dingle Peninsula in Southwest Ireland, all those peninsulas that stick out into the sea, it's much, much easier to cross from one peninsula to the other by boat than it is to cross a peninsula by going over a mountain range. So the connections are very much, you know, along the lowland coasts and across the sea rather than across the mainland as we might think of today.
Oh, we'll have to have further conversations about that. That's a really, perspective, would you say? Anyway, apart from setting off to Arran in and Kilmartin in September, what does the immediate future hold for you, Sue? What's next on the
getting
horizon?
My PhD finished.
Yeah.
So actually, I booked that trip as a kind of celebrating finishing, so that means I have to do it now. So I'm not far off. Yeah. I need to just finish writing my discussion chapter, which is obviously the trickiest chapter of all to write, and just get it in, really. So yeah, it's been a labor of love, but I have I've been doing it part-time, which is always tricky because, you know, you're juggling various things. I think actually doing a full-time PhD is a much easier thing to do. I'm still, you know, fascinated by it. I think some people get to the end of their PhD and they think, oh, I'm completely bored with whatever subject it is that I've tackled. Yeah. But to me, I mean, there's just tons and tons more questions, more research, more projects to do. So in some ways, I just want to get the PhD in so that I can move on and do lots of other things.
Yeah, one more question before we come to the end of this conversation. So it's a burning question, and that is, how do you manage to bend time? Warp time to do all you do?
I think I just do all of them slightly badly. That's... You can ask my colleagues when I forget something or I don't meet their deadlines that I don't necessarily do all of the things I do with aplomb, that's for sure.
That can't be true.
It's arguably the best answer we've had from anybody.
Yeah. Yeah. So the truth will remain a mystery for the time being.
Yeah,
anyway.
I think there's this constant thing, isn't it? The best people have imposter syndrome all the time. It's that kind of thing as well.
People tend to tell me if you want something done, ask a busy person. So that's me. Yes. I do get a lot of people come to me
so
for things.
True,
so yeah.
So
I also I can't say no to things often. I think that's the trouble with having archaeology as a job and a passion, in that, you know, you're always interested in it. So you either always want to tell other people about it or do the research or find, you know, so it's not like, to me, a 9-to-5 job that I'm glad to get rid of at the end of the day. So that's probably why I spend more time thinking and doing it than normal.
passion counts for a lot.
Yeah.
Yes, we so resonate with that because you know, it's a bit like us, really. You know, this is our job. Is this work? We might work hard, but is it work? No, not really.
Not so much.
No, it's all good fun.
So, it's been fantastic talking to you. And as ever, we could talk for a long time because there's so many avenues, you know, that we'd like to, you know, dive down with you. But for the time being, we will say thank you very much indeed for the pleasure of talking to you. Hope you enjoyed it
too. Thank you for having me. I have. Yeah.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. We've been looking forward to chatting with you for a long time. So, yes. Thanks again. And we must do this again sometime.
Thank you.
So goodbye to you. Bye-bye to our listeners and watchers. Thank you for watching. See you again soon, folks. Bye-bye.
Bye.